Joshua 8th chapter, and we've gotten down about the 32nd verse, but I think we'll back up to the 30th verse. Joshua 8:30. Now they have just gotten through destroying the city of Ai. And remember, they got defeated when they first went against Ai. And that is because they depended on their own strength, particularly, instead of inquiring of the Lord. If they didn't inquire to the Lord, they'd have found out about the defection in the case of Achan, and it would have saved them a few lives. But they went in their own strength. And we'll soon be in another chapter where they fail again. But we'll not anticipate that yet. But after the destruction of Ai, verse 30, then Joshua built an altar unto the Lord, God of Israel, in Mount Ebal. Well, that's about 6 or 8 miles from present Jerusalem. As Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones, over which no man hath lift up any iron. And they offered thereon burnt offerings unto the Lord, and sacrificed peace offerings. Now, among the heathen, it was, of course, a habit of making very ornate altars for their gods, decorated and so on, the steps and so forth, so that the priest would be high and lifted up when he made the offerings and so on. It was very ornamental. But God did not want Israel to use their own handiwork, their own skill in this, but that they should use stones that had not been hewn or formed in any way, and not to have steps up to their altar and all that sort of thing as the heathen did. It is to be a simple worship, and of course with no works of which man could boast. Now, they had built a beautiful big altar, you know, with all of the trappings on it and so on, why then they have something to boast of. The principle is run through all through the Bible along that same line. Not of works, lest any man should boast. And notice that they're doing what Moses had commanded. Now Moses hasn't been dead very long yet. And we read a little of his farewell message to them in the last part of the book of Deuteronomy. And here Joshua wrote upon stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he wrote in the presence of the children of Israel. Now, of course, that would probably be the Ten Commandments, would it? He wouldn't write much more than that on stone, would he? A copy, a duplicate. Where was the original stones? The very first ones that the Lord wrote, Jehovah wrote, in Mount Sinai. What happened to them? Yeah, got busted up. All right, what happened to the second set? What did they do with those? All right, put them in the ark. That's right. So he came around the ark. Now he's making a copy here to set up so that people can see. And all Israel and all their elders and officers and their judges stood on this side the ark and on that side before the priest, the Levite, which bare the ark of the covenant of the Lord, as well as the stranger, as he that was born among them, half of them over against Mount Gerizim and half of them over against Mount Ebal. Now Gerizim, of course, you'll recognize that name. That was where Samaria, the capital of Samaria, was built, Mount Gerizim. And Ebal, now those two are close enough, those two mountains close enough that somebody could stand on one, somebody stand on the other, and they could talk to each other. This is not the great big mountains as we think of. They're pretty good size, but as far as their tops are concerned, they were a fair amount above sea level for that land. Jerusalem itself is about 2,600 feet. That isn't very high, according to what a lot of them we have in our country. I taught school in a city that was almost twice that, above sea level. But being close to the Mediterranean Sea and not having all of the high land intervening, that makes a difference. For instance, I have taught in a city that's 2,000 feet above sea level, and it's a plain where they raise wheat along the border of Montana and Canada. And that country right in through there is overrolling a little, but the average height in there is at about 2,000 feet above sea level. Well, you see, Jerusalem is just a little higher than that. It's on a mountain. I'm just giving these things so you may get an idea and get comparison. And so the people are gathered here, and so that Moses could stand up on a higher place and read to them, and they could hear. Now, sometimes in a valley like that, the acoustics are very good if you don't get too much echo. Now, when you've got them all around you, like a basin, a small lake where we have been, and mountain peaks and cliffs all around it, you get a terrific echo. If a slide would go down a mountainside, which did in the fall quite often, you could hear that echo back and forth maybe 8 or 10 times before it finally die out. Well, if your voice echoed that much and you were starting to talk, why, you see, the echoes would come along and spoil it for you, and you wouldn't be able to hear all of it. So they had to be in a place where they wouldn't have too much echo, and I expect these two mountains here would make that all right. You'd get one echo back, maybe. Now, if you folks want to try echo, just stand out here in the yard right smack in front of the barn and speak, and it'll come back at you. All right, and afterward he, that is Joshua, read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the law. This is not on the stone, but in the book of the law. Now, what that book was at that time, we wouldn't know for sure. But I have a pretty good idea that the Pentateuch was written on clay tablets. In fact, it hardly been anything else for that time. And there was not a word of all that Moses commanded, which Joshua read not before all the congregation of Israel, with the women, the little ones, and the strangers that were conversing among them. Now, that doesn't mean he read the whole Pentateuch. It's the law that they read, and that could be plenty, especially Leviticus. All right, chapter 9. We leave them here. They have taken two cities, Jericho and Ai, and now have built an altar and have read the law. Now they're ready to go on to their conquest, maybe. And it came to pass, when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills, and in the valleys, and all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and Jebusite heard thereof. Now you'll notice there's six of them numbered here. The fullest number of these nations, I think, is 7, and sometimes mentions only 5. And here we have 6. All right, now, when they say this side Jordan, and they are at Mount Ebal, and not far from Jerusalem, then this side would be the west side now, wouldn't it? Before they went across the Jordan, this side was the east side. All right. No, they've left the east side. They've gone across the Jordan and taken two cities that are on the west side. Well, most of these Hittites are on the west side. Amorites, a great many of them, are on the other side, but some on both sides. And I read that verse 1. They heard this, and I stopped at a semicolon. that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. These Israelites coming to this land, they're a danger, so they're going to get together, all joined up together against them, gang up. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon means a high place, and about 6.5 miles from Bethel, 8 miles northwest of Jerusalem. I just to get the location, just north, northwest a little bit of Jerusalem. Now this little town of Gibeon, or other little town, maybe it's pretty good size. But when they heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and the Ai, they did work wildly. Well, we don't use that word much nowadays, do we? We were to be aware of the wiles of the devil. And they went and made as if they had been ambassadors, and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent and bound up, and old shoes and clouted hats upon their feet, and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provisions was dry and crumbly, not moldy. Now you see what they're putting up. And they went to Joshua unto the camp at Gilgal, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, "We be come from a far country. Now therefore make ye a league with us, a treaty with us." And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, "Peradventure ye dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you?" And they said unto Joshua, "We are thy servants." And Joshua said unto them, "Who are ye, and from whence come ye?" And they said unto him, "From a very far country thy servants are come, because of the name of the Lord thy God. For we have heard the fame of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spake to us, saying, Take victuals with you for the journey, and go meet them, and say unto them, We are your servants. Therefore now make ye a league with us." I read quite a little bit there to get the background of that. Now the facts of the case are, these Gibeonites are Amorites. And on the wrong side of the river. Well, as I said, they were on both sides of the river, you see. Now King Og and those on the other side were Amorites, and they were destroyed. And so these Gibeonites are getting afraid. Now, they were supposed to be destroyed. Moses commanded they be destroyed. And so they're coming here and playing a trick on Israel. Now, how could Israel find out about whether this is a trick or not? Easily. How could they have found out about Achan before they got defeated to Ai? If they would have. That's right, Urim and Thummim, but it isn't casting dice. It's the priest's breastplate. They could be inquired before the ark and gotten the word. And they're not doing it here, and they hadn't done it before. They trusted in their own strength, at Ai, instead of inquiring the Lord. And here they are being led into making a decision and being fooled without inquiring of the Lord. Well, we're anticipating. And so they said, "This our bread we took hot for our provision out of our houses on the day we came forth unto you from beyond Jordan," presumably, see, from the rest of the Amorites, but of course they didn't tell that they were Amorites. "But now behold, it's dry and it's moldy. And these bottles of wine which we filled were new, and behold, they be rent. And these our garments and our shoes are become old, but reason of a very long journey."
How far did they go after?
Not more than 5-10 miles. Not very far. Take a walk in a little bit. Yeah. And the men took of their victuals, that is, ate with them, and that'd be a sign of friendship, and also to see how old and moldy they were, or crumbly. And asked not counsel out of the mouth of the Lord, see, which they should have done. Won't they ever learn? And Joshua made peace with them. He made a mistake. He made a league with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swear unto them. And it came to pass at the end of 3 days, after they made a league with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors, and that they dwelt among them. Then entirely fooled. And the children of Israel journeyed, and came unto their cities, that is, these Gibeonites, on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, and Sapphira, and Beeroth, and Kirjathjearim. But they were called Gibeonites because that was the capital. And it was a pretty important city. And the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured against the princes. They had a right to. And all the princes said unto the congregation, we have sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. Now therefore we may not touch them. This we will do to them. We'll even let them live, lest wrath come be upon us, because of the oath which we swear unto them. And the princes said unto them, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes have promised them. Which, of course, would have to do with the temple worship, particularly. A great deal of water to be used for the great brazen bath, or whatever you want to call it, that they had in their tabernacle, and all the utensils and so on, and there was wood needed for the sacrifices, and so they let these folks take care of that supply is on that. So they were really servants or slaves. But that was better than dying at the edge of the sword, wasn't it? Or they thought so anyhow. You see, they knew that Moses commanded that all of them be slain. They knew that. That had gone around. That people had heard that. And so they knew what had happened. And Joshua called for them. And he spake unto them, saying, wherefore have ye beguiled us, saying, we are very far from you, when ye dwell among us? Now therefore ye are cursed, and there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. Well, I don't know. There's a prophecy that someday in the temple of God there may be no longer the Canaanite. That's one of the prophets. Now, whether that refers to the Amorite, because sometimes these were all headed up under the name of Canaanite. So that may be that there's a prophecy of someday that means no longer these Gibeonites hewing wood and carrying water for Israel's temple. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told thy servants, how that the Lord thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore we were sore afraid of our lives because of you, and have done this thing. Looks like they believe God better than some of the Israelites did, doesn't it? Even though they were the false seed, you might say, these Amorites and so on, it seems that God did honor their faith, doesn't it? And now behold, we are in thine hand, as it seemeth good and right unto thee, do unto us. And so did he unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, that they slew them not. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord, even unto this day, in the place which he should choose. When was the Ark of the Covenant finally put in Jerusalem? Well, it had been carried around here and there and everywhere and so on. Finally, it was put in Jerusalem. It stayed at Bethel a great deal of the time. That's... David had it brought in. Now, he didn't have the tabernacle brought in, but just the Ark of the Covenant. You see, they made one attempt once to do it, and that got stopped. One man, when a fellow by the name of Uzzah put his hand out to steady it, he said he up and put it on a cart, and it was made to be carried by priests. And so they made a new cart and put it on that, and he got to jostling around, and Uzzah put his hand out to studied it, and he died right on the spot. So they left it at a man's house in for quite a while, and of course it blessed him a great deal and so on. And finally brought into Jerusalem, and that's where David was dancing for joy, and his wife made fun of him. Then there was disruption. Well, we won't go too far ahead, but just remember it a long time. You see, it's a long time before they took Jerusalem. Saul never took Jerusalem. It was David that took Jerusalem. Now we're taking up Jerusalem. That's the reason I mentioned it. Chapter 10. And it came to pass that Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. Now he feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. Amorites, maybe some of them were pretty good size, because a great many of those Amorites were giants, you know. Wherefore Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent unto Hoham, king of Hebron, and unto Piram, king of Jarmuth, and unto Japhia, and king of Lachish, and unto Deber, king of Eglon, saying, come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon. Oh, they're going to turn against Gibeon because she turned over to Israel. Got herself in trouble, didn't she? For it hath made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. So he says, come on now, help us. We're going to get even with Gibeon for doing that. Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their hosts, and encamped before Gibeon and made war against it. And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp to Gilgal, saying, slack not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us. Now you see what Joshua and his folks have gotten into. Made peace with these folks, and now they're going to have to help them. There's no end to this stuff when you get into it, is there? Yeah. Then help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. It didn't take just 3,000, it took the whole crowd. And the Lord said unto Joshua, he's getting directions this time now, fear them not, for I have delivered them unto thine hand. There shall not a man of them stand before thee. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly, and went up from Gilgal all night. Now it takes a long time to move a big army of several thousand men. It might take all night to move a big host like that from here to Warsaw. And the Lord discomfited them before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goeth to Beth Horon, and smote them at Azekah and unto Makeda. So Israel got them on the run. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and were in the going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven. From heaven. Stones in heaven? Well. Unto Azekah, and they died. They were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with a sword. Oh, hailstones. All right. A hailstorm. Incidentally, this is not the time of the year for to have hailstorms in that part of the country. That's out of season. So there's another miraculous aspect to this thing too. Now they do have hailstorms there sometimes, but not in this particular season. You see, this is not very long after the Passover. Probably getting along this time of the year. And that's when their full harvest time is getting about over. They have their first Thanksgiving in North Pentecost, 50 days after the Passover. So you can get the picture. Israel's got them on the run, and then a hailstorm comes along and kills a lot of them, and there isn't much left. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, Joshua says this now, son, it's S-U-N, not S-O-N, son, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still. And the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and that's in the midst of heaven, that's at noontime. And hasted not to go down about a whole day. Not a whole day, but about a whole day. There lacked a few minutes of being an extra day thrown in there. Now, I have seen many attempts to explain this. Don't know whether I need to explain it or not. Any natural attempt on it unless there's something miraculous about it, is going to cause trouble. Now, one attempt was this, that the earth twisted as it was rotating, and twisted in such a manner that the sun stood at the meridian practically all an extra day. And I've seen pictures drawn to show how that could be. Well, that would throw all the oceans and everything out of kilter, according to the natural law, just the same as anything else would do to interfere with that. Of course, now if the earth stopped rotating on its axis for that time, if you put the brakes on, the oceans would run right over the land, wouldn't they? You see, any attempt we try to make it a natural phenomenon just falls short. We can't. Now, whether there was a mirage and it looked like the sun was shining an extra day and it didn't, well, that doesn't explain the lapse of time. Now, you go forward in the elapse of time for this and the old calendars they had, and this long day happened on Tuesday and took in what would have been Wednesday. The old Egyptian calendars, you go back to it, and it goes back to Wednesday. So evidently, there's a break there somewhere. An extra day thrown in from the ancient calendars. There's another aspect of this that astronomers can work on, and they have. You have the sun standing right over Gibeon. And at that time of the year, that would be just about right. The north of the equator, see. It isn't midsummer yet. It isn't when the sun is at the zenith. And the moon is to stay in a little gun sight pass, they call it, Ajalon. Now, any astronomer worth his salt can take those bearings and figure out the year, the month, and the day, and it has been done when that happened. Well, they can explain that much, but how it would happen, how it did it, you don't know. Now, it was a few minutes off. It wasn't quite 2 days. Now, it's exactly 2 days off. Well, where'd the rest of the time go? Yeah, King Hezekiah, it's in the Chronicles, I believe it is, that a sign was given, and the shadow of the sun backed up on the sundial and made exactly the time up to make the whole day extra. Well, now, those are interesting facts we can't explain yet. What happened, we don't know. As I said, any natural way of explaining it would cause a lot of trouble. Now, we can get a natural explanation there. For instance, as we have spoken of, the crossing of the Red Sea, that there was a blast of freezing air came and blew the waters aside and froze the mud in the bottom and froze the waters up on either side and for several miles, and Israel crossed. And that could well be. And the same way with the River Jordan. It could be miraculously stopped up with a landslide and the waters held up through up to Adam, from Adam to the Dead Sea, which is always seems a little something, but from Adam to death. And, of course, where was the course interrupted from Adam to death? Dead Sea, where was that actually happened? That's a foretelling of something. Well, Calvary. Christ rose from the dead. He died and rose from the dead, and There was an interruption. He didn't stay dead like other people. Well, you can look around and find many of these, but just to explain by a natural phenomenon today how that sun stood still, and of course that appeared to stand still. The sun wasn't going around the earth. We always speak of it that way. And I don't think those folks were ignorant either. Because even back in the book of Job, you find the earth is hung upon nothing, and there's every indication in the scriptures that they knew that the earth was a globe. But the heathen lost that knowledge, and so we have even some people, even today, some sects in Christendom who, I guess, still believe that the earth is flat. I can remember when I was a youngster, they always talked about the jumping off place. You could go and go and go and drop off into nothing. Of course, I never figured what had happened to the oceans if they didn't have something to hold them at that jumping off place. Of course, that's what Columbus sailors were afraid of, you know, they might sail out and out and know once they drop off and that'd be it. Well, now, maybe we have digressed about long enough on that, but there's a problem, see? And,
on TV the other night, half of the mob
over there still like you're flat. Oh, yeah. He said that his father had never been more than 10 miles on the country. Well, just think. In my own lifetime, I never was out of the state of Indiana until I was close to 25 years old. Never seen a mountain. Well, we didn't travel much back in those days. I mean, back in the days you're speaking of there, now just for instance here. Of course, it's quite a way from Jerusalem to Babylon. But Jeremiah was a captive in Babylon for almost 70 years before he found out. Well, it was less than that. Or he found out that Jerusalem had been destroyed and the temple destroyed. Well, it was, count from 496 to 454. I'm going to say 70 years, but it wasn't that much. Yeah, you subtract your 454 from 496. That's 40-some years. I was thinking at first, you see, of clear down to the building of the temple when they got out, but the decree was given by Xerxes or Ahasuerus to Nehemiah in 454 B.C., and it was 49 years yet until the temple was dedicated, Jerusalem rebuilt, and so on. So you see, there's another 49 years there. So I have to watch my figures. Well, you see, news like that didn't get to them. They didn't know about it. And of course, Nehemiah was awfully sad about it. The king caught on to something was wrong and questioned him, and so the whole story came out. Well, now let's see. I lost my place. 14. Yeah. And Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, into the camp to Gilgal. But these five kings fled and hid themselves in a cave at Makeda. And it was told Joshua, saying, the five kings are found hid in a cave at Makeda. And Joshua said, roll great stones upon the mouth of the cave and set men by it for to keep them. And stay ye not, but pursue after your enemies, and smite the hindmost of them. Suffer them not to enter into their cities, for the Lord your God hath delivered them into your hand. And it came to pass, when Joshua and the children of Israel made an end of slaying them with a very great slaughter, till they were consumed, that the rest which remained of them entered in the fenced cities. Now, what's a fenced city? fenced city. Yeah, there'd be walls around the end. They called them fenced cities. So it wasn't a woven wire fence or a barbed wire fence or electric fence or something like that around them, as we think of fences, maybe not, or even a rail fence. And of course, not many people know today of what rail fences were. And yet, one of our great presidents was a rail splitter. All the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makeda in peace. None moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. Well, they really had them licked. Then said Joshua, open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings unto me out of the cave. And they did so, and brought forth those five kings unto him out of the cave, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. And it came to pass, when they brought out these kings unto Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel, and said unto the captains of the men of war which went with him, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near and put their feet upon the necks of them. I suppose they tramped on them. And Joshua said unto them, fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus saith the Lord, to do all your enemies. For this shall the Lord do to all your enemies against whom you fight. And after Joshua smote them and slew them, and hanged them on five trees, and they were hanging upon the trees until the evening. And it came to pass at the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded, and he took them down off the trees, and cast them into the cave wherein they had been hid, and laid great stones in the cave's mouth, which remain to this very day. This very day, that is the time of the writing, Joshua wrote it. And that day Joshua took Makeda and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof he utterly destroyed, them and all the souls that were in. He let none remain, and he did to the king of Makeda as he did unto the king of Jericho. Then Joshua passed from Makeda, and all Israel with him, unto Libnah, and fought against Libnah. And the Lord delivered it also, and the king thereof, into the hand of Israel. And he smote it with the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were therein, and he let none remain in it, but did unto the king thereof as he did unto the king of Jericho. Now notice he says he smote the city with the edge of the sword. Figure of speech. Well, watch those. Of course, it means the people of the city. Over in the New Testament, you have some figures used like that, and people get all mixed up about them. Sometimes there's an actual meaning of the city, sometimes it stands for the people that's in it. You have to watch it. Context only can tell you. I think we better quit right there. Verse 31. Got some more here to conquer before we get down to chapter 11. So we'll make a change here.